And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We have a great show for you tonight. We have an in-studio guest, our first one, Aaron Cadju, of the documentary The Bridgewater Triangle. That's been years of UFO sightings and all sorts of paranormal things happening in a triangle that's not really that far from where we are right now as a crow flies or UFO flies. No, I'm not going to go there. And Aaron is coming up right after the music break. And one thing I want to say, since I've gone live here on the Dark Matter Radio Network, I've been getting all kinds of very kind emails from new listeners. And I want to do a quick shout out to Annette, Daniel, Joe, Jason, Jake, Jenna. Can you believe all those J's? And Orion A. Thank you all. Thank you for listening. And come back. Our amateur astronomer, Andy Fleming, will be back next week. He made way tonight for a special guest, a UFO journalist and playwright, Ryan Sprague, and he's live at the 2014 International UFO Congress in Scottsdale, Arizona. What's going on, Ryan?
Hey, Martin. So glad to be with you, man. It has been a whirlwind, my friend. I left New York City last night with 15-degree weather, and now I'm in Arizona, and it's maybe 85, so I'm absolutely, I know. we just wrapped up our first day here at the Congress with a bunch of fantastic speakers. We had an experiencer session this morning, which is closed off to the press, but it's where anyone who's had abduction experiences or contact get together and get to tell their stories to one another and try to come to some sort of, not conclusion, but try to find some answers with each other. So that was pretty interesting, to say the least.
Now, that's on, I saw on the schedule, that's on every, isn't it every morning?
Every morning. We've got a couple at night as well. But yes, it's every morning. And these things, they get filled up so quickly. There's only, you know, so many seats that you can get into these small rooms. And they have Yvonne Smith, and I believe Leo Sprinkle was here last year, listening to these people's stories and, like I said, just really trying to get to some sort of semblance to what is happening to these people. And it was very emotional, to say the least. I really got to see the human side of this very otherworldly phenomenon. So
now, in the 2:30 this afternoon, were you able to listen to Mike Cleland?
I did. Oh, my God.
Because that's one thing you always hear about. It was about owls, synchronicity, and the UFO abductee. And there's always this weird thing you always hear about. People think they see something, and then it's an owl or back and forth. It's kind of strange.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe we can go into that another time. But I wanted to tell you, tomorrow, I was looking at the schedule, you are going to be blown away by a speaker you have. I believe it is tomorrow, and I'm trying to pull it up here right now. And that is Bennett. Didn't I see Bennett was out there?
Let me see here.
This is kind of awkward. I could have sworn I saw Bennett was coming up. Jeffrey Bennett, that's on Friday. Pardon me.
Yes, Friday, there we go.
1 to 2. That guy is worth going to the conference alone just to see him. He's amazing.
Yeah, we've got a few people. Let me see. Bennett's an astrophysicist. Yeah, we have a few people in the scientific realm who really are sticking their necks out and coming forward and talking about this topic at a UFO conference, you know. A lot of scientists see that as a dead end and the end of their career. But these, I really commend Bennett, and we have an astrobiologist coming in as well. I really credit these men for having the courage to come forward and give their opinions on this topic. And who better than the people who could really give us some straight answers when it comes to the scientific aspect of the phenomenon.
Right, right. Yep, so it's going to be a real fun week for you there. Can you talk quickly about you just started a book recently.
I did. I've been writing articles for a really long time, Martin, and I've been looking for a way to really, you know, funnel all of my personal insight into the phenomenon into one cohesive thing. And, you know, what better than a book? So I actually got in touch with our mutual good friend, Richard Dolan, shot him my ideas, and he was just completely 100% behind it from the start. He said, you get this done, and I will publish it in a heartbeat. So I'm very excited. That's a lot of pressure on my shoulders coming from someone like him. But I'm about 3 chapters in right now. I'm gathering so much information just this first day here at the conference from people. And, yeah, it's going to be a book really touching on the human aspect of the UFO phenomenon, whether it's abductions, sightings, encounters, really getting to the core of how it affects humans and what that might tell us about what this phenomenon might be.
Now, make sure when you go to the Q&A session with George Norrie, and people are taking pictures everywhere, that you're wearing the podcast UFO t-shirt.
Of course. I will make sure I get that up on your Facebook page immediately. Thank you so much for that, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, Ryan, thanks so much for being on and letting us know what's going on there.
My pleasure. Have a great show, Martin.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. So everyone hang in there. Right after the music break, we'll be talking with Aaron. And sign in on our chat room on podcastufo.com. It's right there on the sidebar. And we'll be right back. Stay with us. Aaron, welcome in studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, this is great to actually look at someone while I'm recording.
You said this is the first time, right? In studio guest?
That's right.
Well, it's an honor.
Yeah, all right. And you drove up, like an hour and a half.
About an hour and a half when it was all said and done, yeah.
Yeah. And so let's talk about the triangle. And, well, first of all, before we go there, I want to know why you got involved in it. And then how did this all develop into this movie, The Bridgewater Triangle?
Well, I had done a short 30-minute documentary when I was in college called Inside the Bridgewater Triangle back in about 2003. I was a student at Fitchburg State, and I had done that documentary because I was looking for something spooky to do a documentary on. You know, Halloween's my favorite holiday, so I'm kind of gravitate to that subject matter. I was researching Spidergate Cemetery in Worcester and came across Christopher Pittman's website, cellarwalls.com, and he had a large article about the Bridgewater Triangle. I started reading more about it. I grew up 8 miles down the street from the Freetown State Forest and knew the reputation of that place. And I learned that it was part of the overall context of this Bridgewater Triangle. And I said, wow, that's a really interesting topic. And all of those things are local. They're accessible. So let me do this film. So I made the film back then. I used copyrighted music and images. It was just a college practice film, essentially. Gave a copy to a friend who then gave it to a friend. And then all of a sudden, I was getting phone calls and emails on a regular basis from people asking for copies of the film. And I couldn't give them away. And then just in the back of my mind, I said, if I ever am more well-established in this business, have more experience, and am running my own company, maybe I'll reapproach doing a feature-length documentary on this subject that seems to be an interest in it. And then fast forward to 2010, I was laying the groundwork for doing another documentary on the Bridgewater Triangle, a real feature-length doc. Came across Manny Familare's information online and found out that he was planning on doing a documentary, and we kind of joined forces and then finished it 3 years later.
Uh-huh. And how? So you said it took about 3 years to do?
3 years, but that's with two guys who were doing that in their spare time. You know, I was working full-time, running my own business, and my wife and I had just had a baby, and so I worked on it when I could. The actual edit of the movie started in January of 2013, and we finished in October, a couple weeks before the premiere.
Now, where did you gather all this information?
Some of the information for this film was based on the script for the original film, but the original film was only a third the length of this film. So that's where Manny really came into play. He had been researching the Bridgewater Triangle for years, had spent a lot of time in microfilm rooms pulling up old articles, and had a lot of contacts in the area of different researchers. And I had learned more of the different researchers that are involved in looking at the Bridgewater Triangle, and we were able to feature pretty much every major player when it comes to Bridgewater Triangle research in this one film.
Now, there's a museum that's actually in Portland, Maine, with some artifacts.
Yeah, the museum is run by internationally renowned cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman, and he actually came up with the concept of the Bridgewater Triangle back in the late 70s. Mm. He had moved from California to Massachusetts, put his ear to the ground for strange happenings, as he did everywhere that he lived, and kept getting reports of odd occurrences down in southeastern Mass, and he kind of pinpointed the locations on the map and came up with this concept of the Bridgewater Triangle, which was kind of a take on the Bermuda Triangle, which was a hot topic at the time. And 30 years later, it's just sparked this phenomenon along the way, and more and more people know about the Bridgewater Triangle, more and more people are researching the Bridgewater Triangle, and a lot of reports have come out of the area. And whether or not it's really a triangle is up for debate. You know, the borders are disputed amongst different researchers on whether it is a triangle or not, but Lauren has since moved to Portland, Maine, and has the International Cryptozoology Museum up there, where he has artifacts and things related to cryptozoology, and gets, you know, people to come to his museum year-round.
Oh, I see Lee is on the Are you on a chat room or
in the chat room?
Okay, and he wants to know the dimensions of the triangle, and you know, just go ahead and point out some landmark towns.
Sure. The northern apex of the triangle is the town of Abington, Massachusetts. The southeastern apex of the triangle is the town of Freetown, Massachusetts. And the southwestern apex is Rehoboth, Massachusetts. And then it encompasses all of the towns in between. And in the end, it's about a 200-square-mile region.
200-square-mile. Uh-huh. Now, of course, this is a UFO show, but we, every once in a while, we do talk that there seems to be all kinds of things happening where there's UFOs sighted. You know, there may be UFOs sighted. This topic has come up quite a bit. I had Nick Redford on a little while ago, and it came up that, you know, people see orbs. They see Bigfoot sightings sometimes. The same place they're seeing a UFO phenomenon. And, you know, it's kind of follows. But there's a lot more that went on than this. Why don't you go into the different types of paranormal things that have happened?
Well, within the Bridgewater Triangle, there are a series of different locations that are known for different things. And often seen as the heart of the Bridgewater Triangle is this large wetland that is found in the towns of Bridgewater, West Bridgewater, Norton, Easton, Raynham. It kind of skirts into all those towns. It's called the Hockomock Swamp, and it's the second largest wetland in New England. And that location is known especially for cryptozoological sightings, or, you know, Bigfoot sightings, Thunderbird sightings, and, you know, phantom dogs, phantom pumas and cougars and all sorts of crazy things like that, giant snakes, giant turtles, you name it, it's been seen in the Hockomock Swamp. But then along with that, you have a lot of UFO sightings in that region as well, especially around an area that's surrounded by the swamp called the Raynham-Taunton Dog Track, which is now, they don't actually do dog racing in Massachusetts anymore, but the track is still there. And there's a lot of strange occurrences that happen in the skies above that region. And so you have the Hockomock Swamp. The second most well-known location in the Bridgewater Triangle is in the southeastern apex in the town of Freetown. There's a large state preserve there called the Freetown Fall River State Forest. Now, when you get down into that region, you have some paranormal reports in that area of a lot of Native American-related occurrences or related to Native American legend. There's alleged sightings of these 4-foot-tall, troll-like creatures called puckwudgies that are reported down in the Freetown State Forest region. And also in this Freetown State Forest, the area has a history of an elevated level of criminal activity. Freetown's a sleepy town of about 9,000 people, but when you get into some of the things that have happened in the Freetown State Forest, it's just way off the scale for a region of that population. And a lot of researchers theorize that the negative energy of the Bridgewater Triangle is what draws this criminal element into the Freetown State Forest in the southeastern portion of the triangle.
Yes, I spoke to someone I share this office with, actually, about, you know, the Bridgewater Triangle. I mentioned it to him, and he goes, oh, like he knew about it. He said, there's a lot of things going on. And I said, like what? And he goes, murders and, you know, all kinds of abductions, not the alien kind, but, you know, kind of strange things happening there.
Yeah, and like I said, it's kind of by region. And then in the southwestern apex, you have the town of Rehoboth, which is known for a laundry list of ghost sightings that have occurred through the years. It's a very old colonial town, one of the first settlements in the history of the United States, and has a very higher than average number of cemeteries within the borders of this town. And it's just a laundry list of various ghost sightings in Rehoboth.
Now, the UFO sighting that the sportscasters...
Yes.
Can we talk about that? Because that was that's a great UFO sighting.
Yeah, that's probably the most famous UFO story to come out of the Bridgewater Triangle in the 30 years since Lauren Coleman.
Do we want to save that for the end of the show?
It's up to you. It happened in 1979, the spring of 1979, which was a hot time for UFO sightings in that region. Two WHDH news reporters named Jerry Lopes and Steve Sprazier were heading to the Raynham Dog Track after work for some drinks. They got off of Route 24 on the 106 exit, and as they were coming off the exit, Steve Sprazier noticed a large, strange light approaching them from just over the tree line. And it started to get closer and closer, so they actually pulled their car over to the side of the road, and both of them claimed that this large, home plate-shaped object flew just above the trees at a very slow pace. Steve Sprazier said it looked like it was about the size of five 747 stacked wing to wing across. And it just slowly just passed right overhead and then just all of a sudden just took off and disappeared. And it was, like I said, the shape of a baseball diamond home plate.
And for those of you in different countries that don't know what baseball is, or play baseball, I should say, it's like a sort of a triangle that's a rectangular boxed or something.
It's like a rectangle with one of the sides having a triangle sprouting off of it. I guess that's the best way you could. Yeah.
There's probably some geometric form. I just can't think of it right now. But anyway, and very large. And there were other people that actually saw it, and they drew exactly the same thing from miles away.
Yeah, not even that particular instance. There was a lot of reports of that same object coming out of the region in the spring of 1979. So the Brockton Enterprise started collecting all these stories from all these various eyewitnesses from different towns in the area that were seeing the same thing. And their sketch artist came up with a drawing that looked exactly like what Steve Sprazier and Jerry Lopes saw, and they actually featured the drawing in the newspaper article, which is actually shown in the film. And Steve Sprazier says, this is exactly what I saw. And actually, Steve Sprazier has a little wooden model that he put together to represent what he saw.
Wow. Yeah, and the person sort of corroborated also that it was huge, like two or three football fields.
Yeah, the second gentleman named Ron Baker had a sighting of the same craft in Easton. And he said it was about the size of two or three football fields put together, but the same description, you know.
Yeah, so if this could be military, I find it very hard to believe. I did hear that one of the people said that they did hear like a humming noise as it was moving along.
That was Ron Baker. Yeah, he claimed that he could hear some sort of an engine driving the craft. I am not a paranormal researcher or even really a paranormal enthusiast. I'm a filmmaker who found an interesting topic. And I approached it from a very skeptical point of view. I walked into this project probably a 99% skeptic, and I walked away from it still a 96% skeptic. But the sightings of this craft in this region was one of the stories that really made me kind of take a step back and say, wow, maybe there is something strange going on down in that region. But what struck me as odd about the descriptions of this craft was how slow it was flying.
Right.
You know, for a craft that gets its lift from air, from traveling air, it would be hard to imagine a craft traveling that slowly and still being able to stay afloat, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a skeptic, what makes you have the drive to to research as much as you do in this?
I've just, like I said, I'm drawn to spooky, dark, morbid topics. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily a believer, but I think it's fun and interesting. And like I said, it was a local subject. It was accessible. And I just found the topic interesting. Even if you don't necessarily believe all the stories, it's interesting to dig a little deeper to figure out what's driving this then and why is this such a phenomenon in the area. Is it something about the human psyche or is it, you know, you can go into so many different directions with it. And I just was drawn to it. And that's why that's why I was a part of this project.
Now, if you want to ask any questions, you can, I see someone just joined us. Hey, Bobby, you can join us in the chat room and that's at podcastufo.com. Or I'm going to let you call in, and because I'm face-to-face here, it can be easy to take a phone call. That's 603-967-4030. Once again, 603-967-4030, and we'll also let you Skype if you'd like to. And the Skype name is Marty Willis. That's M-A-R-T-W-I-L-L-I-S. So let's talk about the ancient past, as far back as is known in the area, if there was anything going on.
Well, the earliest reported sighting of a UFO in the Bridgewater Triangle, which was probably the first reported odd occurrence in that region, was in 1760. The colonials claimed that there was a sphere of fire in the sky, almost matched the description of like a meteor or like a comet or something like that.
Wait a minute, that's before Roswell?
Oh, long before Roswell. Yeah. But this was 1760, and the only reason we didn't talk about it in the film was we couldn't find the exact source. You hear all these people citing that event, but to actually find the source of it was impossible to track down. So we didn't have enough information to really delve into that UFO sighting. So the next oldest one was in 1908, two undertakers were driving their carriage on Halloween night in Bridgewater. Yeah. And saw a mysterious lantern in the sky that was moving in ways uncommon to any craft that was known at the time, like a hot air balloon or anything like that. And that's probably the next oldest UFO sighting that gathered any kind of weight in the Bridgewater Triangle.
But were there, like you mentioned, Native American?
Yeah, the region has a long, just like any other region in the United States, has a long history of the indigenous peoples before the colonials arrived. And the Bridgewater Triangle is no exception to that. And, you know, there were tribes living in the area. At the time that the settlers arrived, it was the Wampanoag, the Narragansett, the Massachusetts, the Nipmuc. And there are a lot of Native American legends in the area and a lot of Native American lore attached to regions like the Hockomock Swamp. And they saw it as a sacred place, not necessarily a place to fear. They used it for hunting. They used it for trapping. They used it for fishing. And when the settlers arrived in Plymouth, the relations were uneasy. And by the time Massasoit, who was the chief of the time, had passed away, and eventually his son, Metacomet, became sachem of the Wampanoag. And by the time he became sachem, the relationship between the Wampanoag and the Native American population and the settlers was very strained. And actually, war broke out in 1675. The bloodiest war in American history on a per capita basis was King Philip's War, which was this war that took place. King Philip was the English name given to the Wampanoag chief, Metacomet. And a lot of the major battles took place within the confines of the Bridgewater Triangle. Now, the war spread out to Massachusetts Bay Colony, Rhode Island Colony, and Plymouth Colony. So, but the war sparked in southeastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island, in that area that was disputed at the time, like Bristol, Rhode Island, Swansea, Massachusetts area. That's where the war started, and a lot of the major engagements took place in the towns in the Bridgewater Triangle. And a lot of researchers and enthusiasts cite that event as the event that sparked the negative energy of the Bridgewater Triangle. Mm-hmm. And some people cite that as the reason that there's an elevated level of high strangeness in the area. But we present it as a theory in the film, but we don't necessarily try to ram anything down anybody's throat in the film. It's kind of just, here's the theory that people present. This is the information. You make your own determination about it. But there are also a lot of stories of a Native American nature that come out of the Bridgewater Triangle. And there's a lot of locations associated with Native American history. Mm-hmm. As well.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. A person's asked a couple of times here about Quabbin. Do you know what that means?
Quabbin, the reservoir out in western Massachusetts, the only Quabbin that I know.
That was an Eric. Okay. He was also asking about Bigfoot sightings?
Yeah, there's been an abundance of Bigfoot sightings, especially in the Hockomock Swamp region of the Bridgewater Triangle. In 1978, a gentleman named Joseph DeAndrade claimed to have seen Bigfoot at a small pond in Bridgewater called the Claybanks. Mm-hmm. And he saw this alleged Bigfoot creature across a pond in wintertime. Now, I've been to the location myself. We interviewed Joseph DeAndrade extensively for the film. And it comes to the question how sure he could have been about what he saw at the distance that he saw it from, but he swears that he saw a Sasquatch creature at the Claybanks Pond, and he has only seen it once, and he's basically devoted his life to finding it again. And he's had multiple organizations through the years that he was launching expeditions into the Hockomock Swamp and the surrounding area to try to find this Bigfoot creature. And there was another sighting in the early 1980s, a gentleman named John Baker, who was a trapper on the swamp, had an encounter with what he described as a Bigfoot creature while fur trapping in the Hockomock Swamp on his canoe. And he had been trapping in the swamp for years and years and years and had never seen anything strange until he had this encounter with this alleged creature that night.
That doesn't sound very safe in a canoe, seeing those babies. And going back to the I want to go back to the early UFO sighting. I know you said you couldn't find anything to substantiate that, but where did you hear that? Can't remember right now.
I can't remember off the top of my head. If you read a lot of the books that have been published about the Bridgewater Triangle area, mention that sighting. Yeah. And like I said, I don't know where the actual source is for that.
Well, you know, it was kind of like there was a saying about Alexander the Great seeing this big UFO sighting, and it was all spawned from a book that mm-hmm. someone just created. So this is where myth can turn into reality a lot of times when someone will, you know, the folklore that can actually turn into beliefs.
Absolutely.
So we try to stay away from that a little bit here on the show anyway. So let's talk about other sightings besides the one was it Randolph?
That sighting, the home plate shape,
yes.
That was actually in Raynham.
Okay, but there was the one in Randolph that was noted as well.
Yeah, that was just sightings of the similar craft. There was sightings in Randolph and in Stoughton. I don't know the details of those sightings or who reported them, but it was those towns are just north of the Bridgewater Triangle, northwest of the Bridgewater Triangle, and there were similar reports coming out of those towns in the spring of 1979.
Would you say there was any type of what you would call a flap, like several UFO sightings in the general area?
Yes, yeah, several UFO sightings of the same craft.
Of the same craft over and over.
Yeah, that home plate shaped object.
On different days.
On different days, yes. Yeah, like Ron Baker claimed he saw it above a restaurant in Easton, whereas Jerry Lopes and Steve Sprazier claimed they saw it above the highway exit on a different day, but in that same spring of 1979.
So this was in 79.
Yep.
In there.
And that's why the Brockton Enterprise published that article with a list of people that had all corroborated sightings of the same craft.
Wow, it's kind of like in Belgium. They had a triangle.
Very similar.
That, you know, that went for a couple of years that everybody saw. Really strange. If something, you know, you kind of think about something like this. If something is actually coming from somewhere else, let's just say another solar system, just for grins. Why would it be going to the exact same place? You know, I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
If it was interdimensional or something like that, it would make more sense. But, I mean, we have no idea what these things are that people are seeing. And it is intriguing. And, you know, a lot of people will say it's military craft. And, you know, it is possible. I'm not going to say it's not. But, you know, when you're talking about something that just can barely move, if that technology could actually be hidden from us, I would be very surprised.
Well, one of the other phenomena that people report in the Bridgewater Triangle, and I don't lend a lot of credence to it because I don't think it's significant in any real way, is sightings of black helicopters. People snap pictures of them in the
really?
Sky and
yeah.
see them flying around. And, you know, I just assume that they're military helicopters on maneuvers and just, you know, they go out and practice maneuvers just like anybody else, like a fireman would practice dragging a hose up stairs to a fire, the military would fly helicopters around in maneuvers and train their pilots. So I don't really see what the big deal is about these black helicopter sightings. Maybe I don't know enough about the whole paranormal realm and the history of UFOs and whatnot to know how important that is. But we didn't even talk about them in the film just because we didn't really see what the significance of that would be. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, you do hear about that an awful lot, it seems. Lee, again, has another question on the message board, and he wants to know, in regard to the craft, was there any radar cooperation at all?
Not that I know of. And as a matter of fact, Steve Sprazier had placed phone calls out to some of the local air bases, I think Otis, and some, you know, law enforcement agencies and whatnot, and there was no reports of any kind of blips on the radar regarding anything like that.
Mm-hmm. That's often the case. You hear that, too. I mean, people have sightings. And so let's, in the whole investigation that you had done this whole time, what was the most fascinating thing that you found for yourself?
That story, the Jerry Loeb, Steve Sprazier story of that craft was one of them. The other was a bizarre creature sighting by a gentleman named Bill Russo that we featured in the film. And he encountered what he described as a 3-foot-tall, hair-covered troll-like creature while walking his dog in the town of Raynham, just south of the Hockomock Swamp.
Yeah, I saw that in a rendition. Did he, like, have that rendition drawn up?
We actually had that rendition drawn up by an artist. We put him in direct contact with Mr. Russo, and basically he worked like a police sketch artist to draw what Bill Russo said that he saw, and that to this day, that depiction of that alleged creature is the most accurate representation of what Bill Russo claims that he saw. Mm-hmm. There's a TV show called Monsters and Mysteries in America, and it's on Destination America. And they actually featured Bill Russo's story in an episode of their show after we had featured him in the documentary. Mm-hmm. And their depiction of the creature is a lot different from what we have in our film. And there were some differences in the story, and it was kind of a sore spot for us with how they kind of changed the details of it. But, you know, they did what they did, and we did what we did, and that's it.
Now, I know you can sort of say an orb is a UFO because it's unidentified, and there was quite a bit of that going on. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, orb sightings. You have orb sightings in pretty much every major location within the Bridgewater Triangle. You have orb sightings in the Hockomock Swamp. Again, behind the Raynham Dog Track, there's an old rail bed that runs through the Hockomock Swamp, no longer functioning, so a lot of people will go hiking and walking back there and, you know, walk through the swamp.
So, do they say it's the swamp gas?
Swamp gas is one of the theories, but you have orb sightings in other parts of the Bridgewater Triangle that aren't swampy locations. You have a lot of orb sightings down in Rehoboth, which is like the spirit of ghostly hotbed of the Bridgewater Triangle. You have orb sightings in the Freetown State Forest, which is not a particularly swampy place. So there are swamps in the Freetown State Forest, but nothing to the size and magnitude of the Hockomock Swamp. So these orb sightings, and you have orb sightings in a location known as Anawan Rock, which is actually the place where the Wampanoag officially surrendered, ending King Philip's War. And that's a location in Rehoboth that has an awful lot of spiritual and ghostly stories to come out of it. And there's a lot of orb sightings there as well. And then you have orbs in the sky. We featured a witness in the film who actually took some video footage of what he thought were some UFOs in the skies above the Bridgewater Triangle. And they were these, to the naked eye, they looked like just like a floating orb. And he bought this video camera, and he zoomed in, and he claimed that you would see these large mother craft changing different colors, and then you'd see smaller craft sprout off of them. And we feature a little bit of that footage in the film, but it's so shaky because he was zoomed in to such a degree, and you have the digital zoom feature on these cameras, so if you zoomed in past a certain point, you get some pixelization and distortion. We tried to steady that footage in post-production, but it's really kind of hard to make out what exactly it was that he was seeing. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't moving like a plane. It wasn't moving across the sky like a plane. It was just pretty much staying in one spot, which was kind of interesting.
Wow. Another question, was there ever any like electrically charged air after a UFO sighting or mental perception anomalies or anything like that reported?
There is a story that we weren't able to get any information on, but it's another one of those stories that comes out of the region, just like the UFO sighting of 1760, that There was a UFO that allegedly flew over the top of a restaurant, again, I think in the town of Raynham, and it caused like a power surge in the restaurant. The lights flashed and the lights went out and the lights came back on, and the patrons went outside the restaurant to the parking lot and they saw like a scorched pavement or a scorched piece of earth.
Wow.
Outside the restaurant, and there was no explanation for where it came from.
Yeah. So what were some other stories that you decided not to put in? And basically the reason, I know it can only make a film so long, but were there some really good ones, but you just couldn't substantiate?
Not that we couldn't substantiate. Well, there were, if we were to cover every single strange occurrence that has been reported in the Bridgewater Triangle, we would have been talking about like a 60-hour series that we would have had to do. One of the things was, houses that are allegedly haunted. There are haunted houses all across allegedly haunted houses all across the country. So is there anything special about a haunted house in the Bridgewater Triangle? You know, we can't really say, but there are just so many of them that it would be almost impossible to cover every single location. One location that would have been fun to cover, but we just didn't have the time and resources to put into it, is Taunton State Hospital, which is one of those, you know, old state hospital facilities that had a history of abuse of patients and whatnot, and there's been all sorts of strange reports that come out of there.
Did you see American Horror Story?
I did not.
Very much like that.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great setting.
So, you know, we didn't cover Taunton State Hospital in the film. We didn't get into the whole Lizzie Borden thing. We mentioned,
yeah, that's part of the triangle.
Fall River's on the outskirts of the triangle. Now, we talk about occurrences that happen in towns that are just outside of the triangle. We, you know, Mansfield, for instance, is a town that's had some strange reports attached to it, but technically speaking, it's outside the borders of the triangle. Same holds true for Fall River. The reason we didn't get into the Lizzie Borden thing is just because it's been done so many times. There's a zillion documentaries on the Lizzie Borden case, and we were trying to tread new ground here. So we mentioned it just to give reference to the city of Fall River, but we didn't like get into any details of that case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, did you find any people as you were doing this that you just didn't buy their story? And you had to walk away?
We would get contacted from people via email or via Facebook message. And when you start running into people that say, I saw the Bigfoot creature in 1990, and then I saw the Thunderbird in 1994, and then I saw a UFO in 1998, it comes across that they're just trying to get seen and that there's not really any legitimacy to anything that they're saying. I just find it too much of a coincidence that one person would see every single phenomenon associated with the Bridgewater Triangle.
Yeah, yeah. One size fits all for it all.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, well, let's talk about some of the other things that are happening and what's going on there. Anything happening there lately, like since you actually
filmed? Yeah, as a matter of fact, and the gentleman's name escapes me, but a Bridgewater State College student recently took some video footage of a strange lights in the sky outside of his dorm room window. It was about 5 to 7 balls of light in the sky that were moving in like a swirling pattern and ascending into the sky. Of course, it set off alarm bells because it was in the Bridgewater Triangle. His video had like 70,000 hits on YouTube within a matter of 48 hours. Wow. I mean, our teaser trailer has 15,000, and we thought that was a lot. And then this guy posts a video of an alleged UFO sighting, and it got 70,000 hits in 48 hours. But a lot of the debunkers have come out and said all that was Chinese lanterns. Oh. Because that Disney movie Tangled came out, and it had Chinese lanterns in the movie, and sales of Chinese lanterns on the internet skyrocketed after that film came out. And there's been a lot of reports of UFOs being confused with these, or Chinese lanterns being confused as UFOs.
Yeah, it's a pet peeve. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not going to get any better either. And they're illegal in a lot of places, and rightly so. I mean, they can start fires pretty easily.
Yeah, I looked at the footage, and I am one of the people that would probably say, yeah, it wasn't anything significant. It was just Chinese lanterns. But there's people that want to believe everything that comes out of the Bridgewater Triangle. And no matter how outlandish or ridiculous it is, they will tie it into the Bridgewater Triangle. So
how far is Amherst outside of the Triangle?
Amherst is way out in western Massachusetts, so it's hundreds of...
I've heard some weird stuff out there, too.
Yeah, I didn't do much research outside of the Bridgewater Triangle region for
Maybe
this.
Maybe it's a
this.
Bridgewater circle. It just keeps
Bridgewater
growing.
Bridgewater blob.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone wants to know in the chat room, and I don't know what this means, but maybe you do. Can you explain about the Devil's Footprint?
The Devil's Footprint, I believe, is in Norton, Massachusetts, and it's just a rock that has a footprint on it, I believe. I don't know much. We didn't cover the Devil's Footprint in the film.
All right. I'm not going to listen to this guy anymore, Eric. All right. So speaking of rocks, now there's some strange rocks.
There's an abundance of strange rocks within the borders of the Bridgewater Triangle.
There's ones that look like faces and then written on rocks.
We'll start with the most well-known. It's a large trapezoid-shaped boulder in Berkeley, Massachusetts, called Dighton Rock. Now, Dighton's the town next to Berkeley, but Dighton Rock's in Berkeley. I don't know why it's that way, but it is.
Glacier moved it slowly? No.
Who knows?
Yeah, okay.
It was actually a large trapezoidal boulder that was in the Taunton River, sticking up out of the water in the Taunton River, and it has a large flat face on it that has all of these bizarre inscriptions on it. And it's puzzled archaeologists for hundreds of years as to where these inscriptions came from. And to preserve the rock, they actually pulled it out of the Taunton River, put it on the banks of the Taunton River in Berkeley, and built a museum around it. Huh. It's called Dighton Rock State Park. And you can go visit and go into this museum, and they have the rock in the back of the museum, and in the front of the museum, they have all these walls covered with the different theories as to who was responsible for these petroglyphs. There's a Native American theory. There's a Portuguese explorer theory. There's a Viking theory. There's a Phoenician theory. Those are the main theories. But then, you know, if you research online, you've got people that attribute it to extraterrestrials, or you got people that attribute it to Chinese explorers. So there's for every theory that you see on the wall in this museum, there's 10 other theories that aren't prominent enough to be featured in the museum.
What is the strongest theory of what that is?
From the researchers that we talked to, inscriptions of a Native American origin are probably the strongest case. I mean, there's such a high Portuguese population down in southeastern Massachusetts. It's the most densely Portuguese populated area in the country. So most of the people down there will say, oh, it was definitely Miguel Cortriel in 1511. He inscribed on that rock, and that's where all that stuff came from. But if you look at some of the other inscriptions on the rock, I mean, they'll take part of a shape of an inscription and say that that's the five or the one. And everything is so – I mean, the thing was sitting in water for so long that a lot of the inscriptions have been heavily eroded. So to say that it's Portuguese explorers is just kind of convenient for the population that lives down there, I think. I tend to gravitate towards Native American origins. And there's a gentleman we feature in the film named Derek Gunn, who's done a lot of research in local geological and archaeological oddities. And he pointed to a rock inscription up in Vermont that has these faces carved on it, these circular faces that have been associated with Native American petroglyphs. And you can see some similar faces on Dighton Rock. We actually feature that in the film. And then there's the theory that it was a billboard, and that everybody who passed by inscribed on it, just like kids nowadays that go make out at the state forest and carve, you know, Johnny Loves Jeannie on a tree.
It kind of looks like that, the way it's so busy.
It's kind of a smorgasbord of inscriptions.
Yeah. Now, I know this is a UFO show, and we're talking about all different types of topics. But there's only so much we can talk about in the UFOs in the area there. But what about the large animals and the birds? And there's a place called Skinwalker Ranch in Nevada that has all these things happening in the same place. So what about the big beasts and the thunderbirds and all that? Where are those stories come from?
As I mentioned before, the majority of the cryptozoological stories come from the Hockomock Swamp region, and the town surrounding the Hockomock Swamp. Now, you had a laundry list of Bigfoot sightings. The first story that we mentioned was that back in 1970, you had a joint coalition of local and state police, and they were allegedly tracking down a bear. Now, the interesting thing about that is we haven't had black bear in southeastern Massachusetts for close to a century probably. Mm-hmm. They were kind of eradicated from the region. And so they claimed that they were hunting this bear in the region at the time. And there's a story that a police officer was sitting in his cruiser, and the rear end of his cruiser got picked up. And he kind of spun his spotlight around and shined it on what he described as something that was walking on 2 feet. And then it kind of disappeared into the forest. And the interesting thing about that is we never were able to track down who that police officer was. I mean, it was back in 1970. But his daughter actually ended up showing up at one of our screenings. And she says, my father swears that that was a Bigfoot creature and not a bear.
Wow.
So,
well, a bear's not going to pick something up.
Yeah, pick up the rear end of a police cruiser actually off the ground and then drop it back down. So there was that sighting. We had a gentleman named Carlston Wood that we featured in the film that claims that he saw a large hair-covered man while playing in the Hockomock Swamp in the wintertime with a bunch of friends because the swamp would freeze, so they'd go exploring into the swamp as far as they could go. They claim they saw this large fur-covered creature. Joseph DeAndre's sighting, John Baker's sighting. And then you have a lot of other whispers of Bigfoot encounters in the Hockomock Swamp, some of them that are more difficult to substantiate. You know, it's always like, my cousin's best friend's roommate saw the creature. So we tried to stay away from that. Mm-hmm. We tried to get as many firsthand eyewitness accounts as possible. Then there's Bill Russo's sighting, which we mentioned, which some people might say maybe that was a baby Bigfoot that he saw. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But then you have the Thunderbird sightings, large winged creatures. That are tied into Native American folklore. In 1970, you had a Norton police sergeant named Thomas Downey, who was actually driving his car in the nearby town of Mansfield, which is actually just west of the Bridgewater Triangle. And he was driving along Winter Street, and he claimed he saw this massive creature with a 12-foot wingspan fly directly up into the sky and disappear above his cruiser. And he's been approached dozens of times for interviews about what he saw, and he never will grant an interview. He'll say that he sticks by his story, but he's not looking to tell his story in any way, and he probably wishes that he had never reported it.
Well, you know, that gives a lot of credibility in my book.
It's the people that either don't want to talk about it or people that wait a long time to talk about their stories. Mm-hmm. Those ones that, like, I hate to keep going back to Bill Russo, but he had his alleged sighting in 1990, and he waited 20 years to finally tell his story. He waited till he was retired. He didn't want to face any ridicule. So he wrote about his encounter on his blog, which then we found, and we were the first ones to give him an on-camera interview about what he saw. But, you know, he sat on that story for a really, really long time before he finally went public with it.
Did you get a lot of your information from the internet when you were researching this film?
Some was from the internet. Some was from Lauren Coleman's book, Mysterious America, which was the first publication to bring the Bridgewater Triangle to a national audience, or national readership, I should say. So we tracked down some of the stories that he mentioned in his book. And some of the other stories were relayed to us from other experts that we feature in the film. And some of the eyewitnesses were just contacts that we had made from some of the people that were in the film, say, you know, you should talk to this guy, you should talk to this woman. So that's really how we found a lot of our eyewitnesses.
There's another question on the message board. And while filming for the documentary, were any readings attempted? Did you try to get any readings for, like, magnetic radio frequencies, like the Skinwalker Ranch I mentioned before?
No. If you see our film, people think paranormal documentary, and they think, you know, people trekking through the woods with cameras and infrared sensors and all that stuff. This was not really a boots on the ground documentary. This was more of a historical look at the region. So we didn't do any active investigating. Really, there's a little hint of that here and there. And we did have one bizarre incident that occurred while shooting an interview in the Freetown State Forest. But for the most part, we didn't do a lot of boots on the ground.
Well, we got to hear that bizarre incident. What happened?
Well, we were interviewing Christopher Balzano in the Freetown State Forest after he had given a tour. Now, you see snippets of his tour that he was giving in the Freetown State Forest throughout the film. And he had locked his keys in his car. And this interview was never supposed to happen because he was supposed to go do a book signing in the next town over. But he locked his keys in the car, so we were waiting for AAA for a couple hours to come let him in. So I had my camera and I said, hey, since we're just sitting around, can I do an interview with you? And he's like, absolutely, sure. So we there was another gentleman there that had this, like, battery-operated light that we used as the only light for the interview because by then it was dark. So we were interviewing Chris Balzano, and the subject of the wampum belt that belonged to King Philip or Medicom came up in the interview. And Chris was talking about how this wampum belt, Philip was sensing that the war was going to end and that he was going to be facing his demise. So he handed the belt off to his war chief, Anawan. Now, King Philip was killed in August of 1676, but by the time he was killed, he no longer had the wampum belt on him. He had given it to Anawan. The war continued for a short period of time, maybe a couple of weeks, and Anawan and the last remaining band of Wampanoag warriors were tracked down to this location in Rehoboth called Anawan Rock, which is where that official end to the war occurred. And when Anawan surrendered, he presented the belt as a symbol of his surrender to Captain Benjamin Church, who was the colonial authority that he had surrendered to. And the belt has since gone missing from history. Nobody knows what has happened to this wampum belt. There's a lot of people that think that it's in a box on a shelf in a museum in England, which is a very strong possibility. Mm. But Chris Baldano was talking about this wampum belt and its association with the Bridgewater Triangle and how there's a lot of people that think that the strange ghostly happenings at Anawan Rock and the strange happenings in the Bridgewater Triangle will continue to happen until the wampum belt is returned to the Wampanoag people. Now, when he was talking about this, the light that we had just shut off, and we got everything back up and running, and there was another gentleman off camera that said, "Hey, Chris, do you realize that when you were talking about the wampum belt, the lights shut off?" And Chris was kind of startled. He said, everybody kind of chuckled, and as a joke, he turned to the turned to the side as if he's talking to the spirits, and he said, "We hear your message. If I could, I would return it." And right as he said that, the light shut off again for a second time. It was the most perfectly timed occurrence. Now, being a skeptic, I still, you know, maybe it's just a really, really strange coincidence. But, you know, even me, I mean, being out in the middle of the Freetown State Forest in the dark and that happening really made the hair on my arms and the back of my neck stand up. It was really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like that forest. They say that anyone that walks through it kind of gets a creepy feeling.
Well, yeah, and we're pretty proud of that moment because there's a lot of paranormal is a very hot topic in today's society. Every major cable network has a show about ghost hunting or UFOs or Bigfoot or whatever, and a lot of them will fake evidence and make a big deal out of nothing, and a lot of them will spend years shooting these shows and never have something happen like what happened to us out in the Freetown State Forest with the lights shutting off like that. It was just a one in a million thing. And it comes up in the film. A lot of people think it was an edit mistake because the film's pretty smoothly edited up to that point. And then all of a sudden, like, he stops talking, kind of looks up, lights shut off, lights come back on, and lights shut off again.
Oh, I saw that. Oh, by the way, I should say that I saw the movie, and thank you for sending it
to me. No problem.
Yes, and before I forget, I don't want to forget this. Where is someone going to find the movie?
Well, right now, it's just like any other movie. We're doing, you know, in-person theatrical screenings. We've had a series of screenings down in southeastern Massachusetts since the premiere on October 20th. So right now, the only way to see it, other than an in-person screening, is we occasionally will have live streaming shows of the Bridgewater Triangle. If you go to our website, thebridgewatertriangledocumentary.com, click on upcoming screenings, you can see when those live shows are scheduled. And basically, you log on, you sign up for a Ustream live stream, you do a pay-per-view, you pay a small sum of money to be able to watch the film streamed at a specific time, like a live pay-per-view event.
I see. And was this a sort of a crowdsource to get this thing together? Did you have people source you to put this movie together?
This was completely funded out of the pocket of the filmmakers. We didn't rely on any outside funding. We didn't rely on any outside help, really. I mean, the only things that I'm a video production specialist by trade. That's how I make my living. So there weren't a lot of things that we needed to outsource for this film. The only two things that we outsourced were the musical score. We purchased stock royalty-free music for the musical score because I'm not a composer. Mm-hmm. And the off-screen narrator was a gentleman named John Horrigan who provided that. But everything else you see on the screen, we did in-house.
Yeah.
Except for we had some artists do some renditions of things, but, you know, we did all the shooting, all the editing, sound design, you name it, we did it.
Now, has this sparked any further interest in doing something else similar?
I'm not opposed to doing another paranormal documentary. You know, there's already whispers of, let's try to do a series. You know, people say, why don't you do a series on the Bridgewater Triangle and, you know, try to get a television pilot off the ground or whatever. But I have some other topics that I'd like to tackle. Maybe I'm very interested in a case that happened in in between New Bedford and Fall River back in the late 80s, there was a string of murders that happened along the highways. They found 9 dead prostitutes, and 2 women went missing that were never found. And it was basically a serial killer that was terrorizing the prostitute population between New Bedford and Fall River. And the case was never solved. And it's a pretty famous case. And it's got a lot of similarities to the Green River slayings. But, I would love to do a documentary on the highway murders. So, like I said, I'm not opposed to another documentary on the Bridgewater Triangle. But would I want to do it right now? I don't know.
There's an Eric that wants to know if you ever plan to do a screening in Western Mass.
Well, if anybody wants to see the film and wants to see it in person and knows of a venue that might be willing to host it, we'd love to talk to them. We've been working with a lot of independent theaters and independent venues that are interested in screening it. So if the thing is, if you get a bunch of people that all want to see the same thing and call a theater and say, we want you to pick up the Bridgewater Triangle, that's probably the best way to see it out in Western Mass. Some venues have been more receptive to it than others. I think we're coming into this as a relative unknown. You know, people don't know us. We have no, other films to say, we did this film, now we're doing this one, show us at your theater. But there's been some theaters like the Alley Theater in Middleborough, Massachusetts we're on our 10th showing there, and all of them have been sellouts. So, we've sold out probably 80% of the shows that we've done so far.
Wow, that's awesome. And what was your favorite part of this whole thing?
Favorite part? You mean in terms of the subjects that we covered?
Yeah.
Or I like the last half hour of the film, which deals with the Freetown State Forest, because that is, we talk about the criminal element.
Yeah, we didn't talk about the Satanism.
Yeah, that's a...
Might as well throw that in there.
Yeah, sure. But that's my favorite part of the film, only because there's a lot of evidence to support it. And as a person who's a skeptic and scientifically minded, I like things that can be proven. So that section of the film, I think, is the creepiest. And if you shut the lights off and watch it alone in the dark, that's the part that's going to give you a real chill.
There were people that did mutilations, and there were some murders, too.
Yeah. There was, back in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, there was a lot of evidence of ritual sacrifice that was uncovered in the Freetown State Forest. And then that ties back to the whole negative energy of that location. I mean, ritual sacrifice isn't necessarily paranormal in and of itself, but people tie it into the whole concept of this Bridgewater Triangle. And they were never able to actually pin that activity on anybody, and you start treading into, freedom of religion, but then you're talking about cruelty to animals. But there were, at one point you would find pentagrams on the ground with like a dead seagull or a dead pigeon in the middle, and then it progressed to eventually finding a dozen baby calves butchered in a remote section of the Freetown State Forest.
Yeah, so there was a lot of those, like, not when you think of cattle mutilations, they're... Did they drain the blood from them?
Yeah, there were 2 instances of cattle totally absent of blood. A dozen baby calves, and then later, before that, I'm not sure, a full skeletal adult cow was found in the same spot.
And there was a bunker?
Yeah, there was an underground bunker with a lot of evidence of satanic rituals taking place there that was found in a remote section of the woods. And if you hadn't walked at it from a certain angle, you wouldn't even have known it was there. But you went down and then it had like children's clothing, these miniature chairs with bindings on them and things like that. Some really creepy stuff.
Wow. Well, that's it. That's really something. So your website one more time is?
TheBridgewaterTriangleDocumentary.com.
Well, that's great. Well, hey, I want to thank you so much for, you drove like an hour and a half and you got to go home tonight too. So
thank you very much for having me.
You bet. So that's it for our show today. If you missed any part of this show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out links and stories in our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Keith Rowland, the producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network. Ryan Sprague, thanks for checking in from Arizona. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook page if you want to catch all the latest news. Peggy's hard at work at that all the time. You can check us out live next week right here at the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump on the chat room. at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you.